We all have a herd to build. Family, friends, business associates, animals, who knows? And who better to tell us how to build that herd than the lunatic farmer himself, who will help us answer the question today, is cultural selection fair?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1052nd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in San Jose del Cabo who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Today, I'd like to start off with a little treat, something that I found many, many years ago and something I like to consider once in a while and hold in my thoughts. It's from Gene Giono, who wrote a little story called The Man Who Planted Hope and Grew Happiness. So follow along for just a second here to help us set the tone for the show here. He began to inspect them one by one with great concentration, separating the good from the bad. When he had set aside a large enough pile of good acorns, he counted them out by tens, meanwhile eliminating the small ones or those which were slightly cracked. For now he examined them more closely. When he had thus selected 100 perfect acorns, he stopped and went to bed. And that begins the show. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're talking with a lunatic farmer himself, Joel Salatin. Joel, why on earth do you call yourself the lunatic farmer? Don't seem crazy to me.
Well, I started doing it kind of as a humorous self-defense and self-preservation mechanism. And many people don't realize that that our conventional neighbors here, you know, do not sit longingly along our fence line and say, "Oh, I wish I could be like Joel." You know, they think we're bioterrorists and nutcases and whatever. And so I just decided, since they think I'm a lunatic, instead of being angry about it or fighting about it or frustrated about it, let's just have fun with it and join them. Sure, I'm a lunatic. I'm such a lunatic that I don't have to call the vet very often. I'm such a lunatic, I don't have to go to the bank and borrow money every day. I'm such a lunatic, I actually make money instead of being grousing all day about how terrible the prices are. You see the point. I finally wrote a book, you know, by the title "The Sheer Ecstasy of Being a Lunatic Farmer," in order to kind of, you know, rub their noses in it a little bit.
Well, there was another kind of lunatic farmer who called himself the contrary farmer, Gene Logsdon.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And there seems to be a whole world of lunatics out there these days, and it seems to be actually more and more and more people are looking toward that lunacy of how to make something really work in our agriculture. Joel, you've been at this a long time now. Have you seen, you know, a big difference in the way people look at food now?
Oh, for sure. You know, when I was selling my eggs on curb market as a 14-year-old, 45 years ago, I would have nobody ever heard of the word, the O word, you know, organic. This was way before all that, and I tell these young people today, man, what a time to start now compared to, you know, when to start direct marketing and actually doing the locavore deal. There's so much more interest, and I call it an integrity food tsunami, and of course, you know, but it's the same physics. For every action that we do, there's an equal and opposite reaction from the industrial system, the orthodoxy, that is trying to, you know, marginalize, demonize, or criminalize this new upstart heresy that's plaguing the country as they see it. And so it's a, you know, it's certainly a fun, exciting time. But yeah, there's far, far more interest in it, and far more interest among young people, which is really, really exciting.
And you work with a lot of young people there at Polyphase Farm too, so you get to know them on one-to-one basis that way. You know, Joel, what you said kind of rings true. I had a phone call a number of months ago from an attorney down in Salinas, California. Michael, did you see the letter, he said. And I said, no, what letter are you talking about? And he mentioned a letter from a large grower-shipper organization. I said, no, what did it say? And he said, if local food is taking a bite out of your profit, join us in Washington, D.C. What do you suppose they would do in Washington, D.C.?
Huh. Yeah, well, what they do is things like, here's the thing, they link up with duplicitous consumers who are paranoid and ignorant about food. And of course, you know, we all fear what we don't know. And so when people don't know about food, they don't know what it smells like when it spoils. They don't know what it tastes like when it's nutrient dense. They don't know a farmer. They don't know. What they do is they tend to ask for Washington, D.C. to protect them from this scary world of food and pass things like the Food Safety Modernization Act and create more and more regulatory oversight. They call it, oversight over food. And what happens is, while it's all well-intentioned and good, the industrial food system glums on to that consumer concern, if you will, and leverages it into regulations that actually inhibit the very antidotes and innovative solutions that scare people, that scare the industry, but that actually have the answers for people's concerns. And so it becomes more and more difficult for those of us who have the answers to E. coli, salmonella, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, pharmaceutical resistance, MRSA, C. diff, nutrient deficiency, name your deal. Those of us who have the answers for that become, marginalized, and it's more and more difficult to actually access our neighbors and friends and communities with food as this oversight, permeates into the countryside. So, it's an alliance that is not contrived. It's an alliance that happens from duplicity, actually.
Well, Joel, if ever there should be a farm that's a dangerous farm, it should probably be Polyphase Farm, because you have so many critters running around in the wide open spaces there. And it just must be the most dangerous place on earth. What is your way of managing all of those terribly frightening bugs that government is so frightened of?
Yeah, well, our answer is to look at the 1,000-year-old template, if you will. There's more and more anthropological evidence. When you look at the megafauna that was in California, Australia, New Zealand, Europe, the U.S., that actually 1,000 years ago, the planet actually had more pounds of animals on it than it does today, even with all the concentrated animal feeding operations and the human population. And so this notion that we're actually becoming more productive is absolutely incorrect. We're actually becoming less productive. And so we look at these tried and true historical patterns and say, well, how was the earth so abundant? How did it grow soil? How did it have all these salmon and clean, waters and all this stuff? How did it do all that? How did it build these aquifers and these inland lakes and all that stuff? And
how did nature work without government, you mean?
Yeah, well, or John Deere for that matter, okay?
There you go.
and so we're looking at those patterns, and so when we, when we come to our landscape, we're saying, okay, there's no animal-less ecology on the planet, so So we got to have animals. So animals become a significant point.
Okay, Joel, we're going to take a quick break. But if you hold on, I'd like to pick that up, that notion up when we come back. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today, we have the privilege of talking with a lunatic farmer himself, Joel Salatin. He, the proprietor of Polyface Farm with his family out there in the Shenandoah River Valley, Virginia. Oh, what a beautiful place. And you are invited to participate, of course. I guess you have to do it via email today. We're at metrofarm.com. You can click on there. Or you can tune in. Joel's coming to Santa Cruz on the 21st, I believe. So Rio Theater, there's a chance to see and visit Joel Salatin. And when we come back from this break, we're going to talk a little bit again about how we survive without the government in agriculture and how we do so and keep safe as well. Do stay tuned, right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
House plants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at metrofarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at metrofarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at metrofarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at metrofarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at metrofarm.com. That's metrofarm.com.
Okay, we are right back. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're talking with Joel Salatin, Polyface Farms. We're talking about how we address those productivity issues and safety issues on farms without the benefit of all of that huge government to watch over our shoulder. Joel is an advocate of direct agriculture, which is to say people and farmers working together to feed each other. That about right, Joel?
Well, you sure it is. We like, you know, a lot of farms have no trespassing signs up. My favorite one is a sign that says trespassers will be impressed. I like folks to come. You know, it does a couple things. One is it helps people to actually, you know, connect to their ecological umbilical and their food chain. But it also creates accountability for the farmer, for us. Guess what? We don't want a bunch of sick animals and sick plants and stink and smell and obnoxious stuff sitting around. So it keeps us on our toes and creates accountability when you have customers running around looking at things.
And when they see is really amazing. So, and, you know, we're talking about building that productivity by looking at nature. When you look back at nature, you saw a very productive operation going on without the help of any government or John Deere, as you said. What on earth was nature doing so well?
Well, what it was doing was choreographing an amazing complex relationship of multi-species, plants, animals, water, you know, beavers, up to 6 to 8% of North America was inundated with beaver ponds, you know, some 2 million beavers. There were over 1 million wolves, way over 100 million bison, and of course elk and antelope up the wazoo. Audubon said he sat under a tree in 1800 and he couldn't see the sun for 3 days because of the flocks of passenger pigeons that flew over him. Can you imagine the sun being blocked out for 3 days from the flocks of birds? Native Americans told about birds coming in, landing so heavily in the trees that all the branches broke down. They got up in the morning and looked out. There was an inch of bird poop on the ground, and all the branches were broken. I mean, the sheer volume of life was incredible. And so on our farm, what we've got is the basis is the herbivore. Now we don't have wolves. So we're the predator. Mm-hmm. So instead of bison, we have cows. We're the predator, and the movement now that, you know, we have personal ownership of land and they don't migrate from, you know, Saskatchewan to Florida and whatever, what we have is electric fence to simulate the kind of tight, clumping, mobbing, moving around that these herbivorous herds did. Then the herbivorous herds, of course, we allow them access to the perennial, which is essentially, you know, a grass or forage plant that is turning sunbeams into carbon, into biomass, and they are this massive pruner. So like if you prune your hedge or prune your apple tree or whatever, well, the herbivore is the pruner of these sunbeam metabolizers called, you know, grass plants, clover plants, forbs, and so they prune them to keep them in a very juvenile, fast-growing cycle so they convert more solar energy and actually sequester more carbon. And so we follow, for example, the herbivores. Well, you know, they drop manure that encourages flies and pathogens and incubates worms and parasites. So we follow the cows with eggmobiles, and these thousands of chickens free range out behind the cows, eat through the cow patties, spread them out for fertilizer, eat the fly larva and the parasites and the grasshoppers and crickets that are now exposed from the pruning cycle, and lay eggs as a byproduct of pasture sanitation. So we use pigs, for example, for large-scale composting. We make thousands of tons of compost, but instead of using big compost turners, we use pigerators, aeration, like oxygenation. We call them pigerators, and we just put in corn. It ferments. The fermented corn feeds the pigs. The pigs, the fermented corn, you know, pays the salary for the pigs to fluff it and aerate it, and that turns the compost, and then that goes, you know, thousands of tons back out on the fields. So we're very much, you know, animal-based choreography with an intricate relationship with plants to animals, plants to plants, and animal to animal, to duplicate this symbiosis that nature created, you know, long before we Europeans arrived on the shores.
Well, Joel, I had the opportunity to look at your grass, as it were, one day in early spring, I think it was. It was a light rainfall, and you took me out to the pastures, and we walked over to the fence line, and you said, "Well, what do you see?" And what I saw was a comparison between the lunatic's grass and the next-door neighbor's grass, who looks at you as a lunatic, I guess. And what I saw in your next-door neighbor's grass was grass that was gray and dismal and laying flat in the light rain and laying on the ground. And then right on your side of the fence, the grass was bluish-green and had a real shiny tinge on it. The grass was standing up straight and tall in the light rain. And the most amazing thing of all, of course, is that when you turn your cows from one paddock to the next, I watched as the lead cow actually skipped, smiling, into the new grass. I've been around cows all my life, and I've never seen a smiling cow like that before.
Well, you know, if every day at 4, we move them every day pretty much at 4 o'clock, and if every day at 4 o'clock you got called to a bowl of ice cream, you'd probably smile at 4 o'clock, too.
Uh-huh.
You know, but, you know, this is a principle that is fascinating. There's a new ebook that's just come out, and I'm getting through it, and it's fascinating, written by a practitioner in holistic management. Brand new thing. I'd never, as much as I know, this was a brand new thought to me. What she pointed out was we're all familiar with compost, how valuable compost mm-hmm. is, and speeds up decomposition, all that. Okay, well, the inside of the rumen of an herbivore, because it's always dark, moist, and
compost.
because it's a mammal, the actual decomposition there is much more rapid than it would be outside. And it's far less risky. In other words, every time something goes in there, it's going to compost. You know, it's not going to just sit because it got too dry or too cold or too hot. And this was a brand new thought. And her point is that the reason that the foundation of all soil-building ecologies is the herbivore is because of this very low-risk, highly stable decomposition place, you know, nature doesn't build compost piles. What nature does is the compost piles are in the rumen of all the herbivores. That's how nature was able to move the decomposition forward faster than any other way. And it's just, it was one of these aha, you know, and I've been around this all my life and never connected that dot before, that the inside of the herbivore is this extremely efficient decomposition process. And that is why when people talk about, well, cows are very inefficient, you know, we need to get rid of them and just, you know, direct grow soybeans for humans or whatever. The point is that their inefficiency is what makes them so efficient for the ecology. The fact that they do poop out and pee out virtually as much weight as they consume, which appears to be inefficient, actually is the reason why all ecological soil building foundation is predicated on herbivores, whether they're mice or gophers or bison or antelopes or giraffes or elephants.
And
quite profound.
And here we've went about getting rid of all of the critters and taking them off the land. And thus we have land that's not being very productive because it no longer has that relationship with life, right?
Yes. Well, and what we've done is that rather than a highly integrated system, we've created a highly segregated system. And so the way this is supposed to be synergistic, where the waste stream of one becomes the blessing for the soil microbes, for example, to be more efficient at capturing sunbeams and sequestering carbon, instead of being a blessing, it becomes a curse.
And got to hold that thought. We're going to pick it up when we get back from this break. Gosh, holy smokes. Okay, we're back. And we're picking up the notion with Joel Salatin of nature being a big player with animals, and the relationship between animals and the earth is, and the productivity that comes from that. And you think back 1,000 years to when there was the great buffalo herds, there were birds in the sky, and now pretty much all gone. And we look at our agriculture without those rumens and the loss of productivity that we're experiencing, but we can bring it back on our own personal level, as Joel Salatin and the Salatin family are doing at Polyface Farms. Joel, how many critters do you have, different kinds of critters do you have on the farm there?
Well, we have, if you don't count the cats and the dogs.
Well, you almost have to, don't you?
Well, you do. Yeah, you have the cats are vermin control,
right?
And the dogs, of course, are coyote and, you know, raccoon. Yep. and groundhog patrol, and so we have cows, and then we have pigs, and turkeys, and laying hens, and meat chickens, and lambs, and ducks, and rabbits. All of that we grow commercially, so it's quite a menagerie.
So
everything moves. I mean, mm-hmm. except for right at the dead of winter when it's snowing, and we come in with, well, we some of it we don't even have, some of the broilers and things, but you know, most of them we come into deep bedded structures. A lot of them are hoop houses so they can stay nice and warm and comfy in the blizzard. But other than that, you know, they're out on pasture, on grass. We're moving them around with electric fences. We have portable water systems, portable shelter systems, you know, nursery shade cloth on Tinker Toy trailers is amazing. You can move it with a little, you know, ATV or by hand. You know, just amazing to have this kind of mobile, modular, management intensive type of farm. That you know, can the whole thing, just everything just moves around. It's quite amazing.
And the reason it moves around is that so you can keep the grass growing. And you are really, but it gets right down to it, you're really a grass farmer, aren't you?
Yeah, well, we say we're grass farmers. We're, because, you know, in the scheme of things, the way the planet works is the sun comes down, and of course, you know, it's beaming energy down, but that energy is is hard to get a hold of. And so in nature, photosynthesis, of course, captures those esoteric sunbeams and converts them into something fungible, tradable, commercial, you know, that's weighable, valuable in plant material. And plants are divided into trees, shrubs, and grasses. I'm using a big, you know, grasses, weeds, forbs, clovers,
right,
those kinds of things. So you have kind of the vegetative plants, and you have the brushy plants, and you have the trees. Well, you know, we tend to look at a forest and say, wow, look at all that carbon sequestration. That's an amazing amount of carbon. But actually, grasses, the more succulent, are actually the most efficient. It's counterintuitive because you're only seeing one season accumulation at a time. If you took, you know, 80 years of the of your, for example, your lawn accumulation and stacked it up next to the tree, it would actually produce, it would actually have way more biomass than the 80-year accumulation of the tree. And so the thing you have to remember is the reason why all deep, fertile soils and aquifers and everything were built over time under forests. Under prairies, not under forests, is because the prairie, the grasses, the prairies are what had this very, very efficient metabolic capacity to convert solar energy into biomass and actually, you know, develop water retentive soil capacity. And you know that, and I'm not opposed to trees. I'm not advocating going and cutting down all the trees, but I am suggesting that is why, you know, from the steppes of Mongolia to the to Argentina, Pampas, to the, of course, the Great American Midwest, Australia. You know, Australia was 20% organic matter in 1820, and now it's less than 1% organic matter. And all of that was a carefully created, I have a book here on my desk called The Greatest Estate on Earth. It's about the early Australia. Now, you know, there were wombats 9 feet tall. How would you like to run into a 9-foot tall wombat? But this megafauna was all over the moa bird in New Zealand was a 6-foot tall flightless herbivore, the only one on the planet, and it only went extinct 600 years ago, which, you know, is not that long ago. I mean, right before the Europeans.
So what happened to all the grass?
Well, the grass then got began turning into domestic livestock, grazing, which did not have, which the farmers, the grazers, did not have a good sense of these very, very carefully balanced choreographs that predator and prey, including, you know, Aborigines and the Maori, you know, the indigenous peoples created for that. And so the farmers went in with a Western commercial interest. Hey, here's a resource. Let's turn it into cash as fast as we can. You know, Sir Albert Howard, in an agricultural testament, says that every civilization is tempted to convert what nature spends 1,000 years creating and convert it into cash. And
as
so,
quickly as possible and get the heck out of town. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And so that cycle ran its course, and now today all of these, you know, livestock are being demonized as anathema to ecological integrity, when actually it's the farmer and rancher, it's the way the animals were managed for short-term gain that was the problem, not the animals themselves, which is, of course, what Alan Savory has demonstrated.
Sure.
And you know, thousands of really integrity folks around the country that are going back with modern technology of water pipe, shade cloth shelters, and electric fence management, we're going back to this original foundational choreography, and it's astounding. Our production here at Polyface is five times the grass is five times the county average. The county average is 80 cow days per acre, and we average over 400 cow days per acre. And we haven't bought a bag of chemical fertilizer or planted a seed in over 50 years. So the power of these ancient choreographs is just is astounding. We're not running out of food. We're not. We don't have too many people. What we don't have is an ethic of humility and biomimicry that appreciates the beauty and the magnificence and the productivity of these very ancient choreographies with modern technology to tweak them and make them work for us today.
Well, it seems like it's much easier to look at nature and think how I can dominate it and take control and run it instead of dancing with it, as you suggest, the choreography of the dance, of working together, of managing the animals so that the animals are managing the growth of the grass. And
well, yes. And yeah, the conquistador mentality is very much alive in Wall Street today and in the halls of, you know, the USDA and the FDA and most of the
and
others.
So on. Yeah. We're gonna take a quick break, Joel, and when we come back I want to ask you the question that I want to ask. Is cultural selection fair? Because you do that when you manage your critters right back.
Yes. Yes.
Read an article in Acres USA some time ago in which Joel Salatin, farmer at Polyface Farm, was remarking at the fact that he had a couple sick cows out in the pasture, and people drove by and saw the couple sick cows and started complaining to the animal rights people or something. Who knows who? Call the sheriff, call the mayor, call the governor. Joel Salatin has a couple sick cows out in the pasture. Well, Joel remarked, had the cows out in that pasture because I didn't want them to be with my good cows, the cows that were doing good. So there is a selection process involved there in building a herd, and that's, guess what you were doing, was making the selection. Is that true, Joel?
Yes, yes. Just like a pedigree dog breeder is going to have, you know, the ones that that are the keeper line, mm-hmm. and then the cull line, you know, and anyone who's in that kind of business understands that sort of thing. And in our, you know, in our modern day again, disconnect with the way this, you know, husbandry and selection works, we're getting this kind of radical animal welfare agenda where, you know, if you don't have an L.L. Bean monogrammed cushion in a air-conditioned anteroom for every animal that you have, it's some, you know, sort of animal abuse. And so, you know, we look at the animals as fellow partners. I mean, we work real hard, and we want our animals to work hard. And if an animal, for whatever reason, can't work hard, can't pull its weight in its ecological niche, then that's an animal that's headed for the cull, you know, the cull group. And the one that does stay fat when things are drouthy, that can find water when, you know, when things are a little bit rough, that can breed back when it's too hot or too cold or whatever, that's not prone to parasites or that sort of thing. You know, those are the animals that we want to work with. And if we just vaccinated willy-nilly or used pharmaceuticals willy-nilly and did what most people, where they just continue subtherapeutic dosing up of different crutches, we would never be able to observe and find the real, you know, the real doers, the real keepers. And so it's part of our working with nature to find those performers that is the reason why we don't call the vet every day something, you know, gets sick, or we don't necessarily do, you know, major you know, salvage trying to prop everybody up. You know, if an animal dies, well, I guess it just culled itself. Now, it doesn't mean we don't love them, we don't care for them, we don't do the best we can, but it does mean that this inordinate imbalance toward animal welfare, that every animal deserves some sort of a heroic IV hospital care, it doesn't recognize this role of animals as partners in this, you know, in this ecological you know, progress. And so this, you know, it's too bad that farmers like us that are extremely transparent about what we do and want to invite urban folks, you know, to come out to the farm and commiserate with the animals and see things, that sometimes they misread, you know, one that's underperforming that they see over here in the corner and you know, expecting heroic efforts for it. And for us, it's just, well, that animal is you know, is letting us know that it's a non-performer.
Joel, it seems to me like this incident in which your neighbors, you know, saw a couple sick cows out in the pasture really is indicative of the conflict between, you know, urban mentality and the productive mentality of the farmer out in the countryside. Because, you know, when you are growing things for a living and you have to grow things that are going to survive and are going to take care of you, you can't not call. You have to call. You have to make your selection. So how do you transmit that must do to people who are living in the city and they think everything has to be taken care of? I mean, how do you change that notion of what's fair?
Well, first of all, we want them to come out and meet us. Let me smile with you. Let me laugh with you. In other words, build a relationship with me. Ultimately, if you don't have trust with somebody, you can't even start a conversation because you're fighters. You just go to your corners if you don't have trust. And so we feel like our first level is we want people to come out, meet us, laugh with us, shake our hands, you know, and feel our, you know, feel positive vibes. You know, these aren't, mm-hmm. you know, these aren't mean-spirited people, all right? That's one. Number two is then we express this. The fact is that survivor genetics is the way nature has worked from day one. You can call it Darwinian genetics. You can call it survivor genetics. You can call it whatever you want to. But the truth is that the reason that herd of zebras out on the Serengeti is within 20 pounds, every adult is within 20 pounds of each other, or that herd of a million wildebeest, is because if one of those zebra mares was 20 pounds too heavy, she wouldn't be able to carry herself through the drought and to walk to water, you know, 10 miles. She'd be too big a, you know, like the Bataan Death March, you know, in the Philippines in World War II. The guys who survived, you know, were not the fat ones, right?
Right.
And then by the same token, if that mare is 20 pounds too small, then she's not big enough to fight back the jaguar and the lion that's going to, you know, affect her calf. And so there's a very narrow window of functionality, and nature tends to move toward this window of functionality. And so what we explain to people is that it's only in not putting artificial crutches under every animal or plant that we raise, but expecting each to pull its weight, that we actually are able to discern and learn and find out where the functionality is. And I would submit that the big picture here is that if we actually want a non-drugged dinner, okay, what we need are functional plants and animals, whether, you know, they don't need chemicals, don't need vaccines, don't need pharmaceuticals. I mean, it goes plants, animals, the whole deal. If I go out and spray my strawberry field, how do I know which strawberry
which is
plant
going to be worthwhile? We're going to take a quick break, right back. Do stay tuned. Okay, we have a couple of minutes left. So much to talk about, so little time to talk about it in with Joel Salatin, the lunatic farmer. That's, he calls himself the lunatic. I can't believe he calls himself that, but he does. And Shenandoah River Valley, the Polyface Farm. And if you ever get a chance to visit, go there. And if you get a chance to tune in on one of Joel's presentations, he's going to be in the Santa Cruz, California area here coming up pretty quick this week. hop on over and get some wisdom that'll last you a lifetime from Joel Salatin. Joel, how do people tune in with your website?
Well, our website is Polyface Farms. That's all one word, just all lowercase. Polyface, P-O-L-Y-F-A-C-E, polyfacefarms.com. And the website has my speaking schedule. It has stuff about the farm. You know, YouTube links. Of course, we're on Facebook as well, doing, you know, routine posts there and different things. But there's plenty of, you know, links and lots of information there, and would welcome anybody to come and peruse the site. We're probably not the world's best at it, but we do our best at least.
Mm-hmm. And you also have open house periodically. You host an open house there at Polyface Farm. Invite folks to come check it out. You can probably find those open house times on your website as well, right?
Yes, we actually do a couple of tours a month. We call them lunatic tours. And people can sign up. It's a two-hour hay ride around the farm. This year we've started the free-range Saturdays, where all the local artisans, from food to fiber work, potters and everything, can come to the farm and just for free. And it's just like a community, kind of like the medieval. It's a recreation of kind of the medieval, you know, the medieval square kind of deal. And so there's a lot here to do. All those dates are on the website, and we would welcome anyone to come by. You know, once you get east of the Mississippi, it's all pretty close.
There it is. Not bad. You know, I had a chance to visit one Polyface Farms one day, and I drove out from Washington, D.C., and saw a bunch of people standing in line as you were butchering chickens. And so I kind of walked up to the line and saw all these cars that come from Washington, D.C., and I said to the lady standing in line, I said, "Ma'am, did you drive all the way from Washington, D.C. to buy a chicken?" And she looked at me and she said, "No, I drove all the way from Washington, D.C. to buy a Polyface Farm Salatin chicken." And I understand why she did, because it's a food that it comes to you full of life. And that's Joel Salatin and Teresa Salatin and the family. Polyface Farms, thank you so much, Joel. Remember, folks, cheap food isn't. Michael Olson's Third Law of the Food Chain. Thanks, Joel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.